Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this 10th session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number, symbol, and geometry. If you'd like to view any of the first 9 sessions, they are available on makara.us, that's M-A-K-A-R-A, thanks to Brett, who is with us today, along with VL, who was and 2 intrepid assistants. Also, Joe is with us today. So thanks to the 3 of you for helping out. Okay, if you'd like to ask questions or make any comments during the webinar, please use a headset. If you don't have a headset, there's a text box in the middle of your control panel that you can use to communicate with either BL or I. And there's really only a couple of other buttons that you need to worry about. The hands up button, by far the most important. It's up in the left corner of your control panel. It's got a little hand with an up arrow. It's a toggle switch, so when you click it, it puts your hands up. When you click it again, it puts your hand back down. And that'll alert BL to call on you. If you have any other questions about the interface, feel free to type them in this text box and BL will get back to you. If you've been regularly attending these webinars and don't yet have a headset, please consider purchasing one. They have them on Amazon.com for as little as 10 bucks, and it's perfectly good. You can get a really good one for not that much money. The more participation we have, even if it's just to read passages, the richer the experience is for everyone. I'm sure that there are those of you who don't have headsets who have really good ideas and you feel like you'd like to speak but can't. If that's the case right now and you don't have a headset, go ahead and use the text box. Type your ideas in. Bill will make sure that they get to me. So also, I've been really impressed with the participation that we have had, and I want to thank you. Last month was terrific in terms of your input, so thanks. Okay, so welcome to our third foray into the realm of fourness. It looks like there's going to be yet another one. Who would have thought there would be 4 sessions on 4? But it truly warrants the attention that we're giving it. We spent most of last month's session considering the tetrahedron and comparing it to 2 figures given out by DK in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. It's the 2 figures on the bottom of this illustration. Today we'll take a final look at the tetrahedron and then begin considering the cube, right? All of you know what a cube looks like. It's the most common of all of the Platonic solids. I want to thank Luka Kovac, who was with us for last month's webinar. I don't know if Luke is with us today or not, but he sent this, the idea for this illustration, which he created by combining these 4 figures, which are, as you'll recognize them from the Discipleship in the New Age symbols, and he just combined them from all 4 directions to come up with this symbol, which is, you know, quite provocative. And one very cool aspect of this is that the tetrahedron is implied, actually 4 of them are implied, by this symbol.
I just wanted to tell you he is with us again today. Luca
is great, Luca.
Attending.
Thanks for this. That's terrific. Okay. Before we move from the tetrahedron into more complex 3-dimensional figures, let's take a look at the meaning and significance of the elements that make up all 3-dimensional figures. We'll start with the point. Let's see here. There we go. The ancient wisdom teachings tells us that the point represents a source, a portal between that which lies beyond time and space and our manifested world, which we call the lower quaternary. But unlike in physical plane geometry, the wisdom teachings tell us that a point does not mark a particular locale, an idea supported by Hermes Trismegistus, who says God is an infinite sphere, the center of which is everywhere, the circumference nowhere. At the center, of course, being equated to a point. It is rather a nexus of concentrated energy. In a letter to one of his disciples, Dwal Kool says, actually, let's get a reader for this. Break the ice. I'd like to know that I'm not alone here. Would somebody volunteer to read this passage from Discipleship in the New Age?
Hands up, please. There we go. Thank you, Walter. Go ahead.
Yes. A rich life of service lies ahead of you, but its full expression is dependent upon achieving a point of focus leading to a point of tension, which will, in its turn, inevitably lead to a point of crisis.
Thanks, Walter. On planetary levels, the point expresses itself as the point of light within the mind of God, the point of love within the heart of God, and the center where the will of God is known. It's interesting to correlate these two sets of three points. Certainly the higher set or triangle stimulates the lower. We may even find a correspondence between the opposing points. We could even hypothesize that the relationship between these two sets of three, one relatively fixed, the other mutable and progressive, define the constantly reformulating lines of what DK calls man the cube. Dwal Kool tells us in Letters on Occult Meditation, and I'd like to have another reader for this. Hands up, please. The more quickly you can raise your hand, the quicker and more we can cover in these webinars.
Scott, you want to do it for us?
Sure. Each life that the personality leads is at the close represented by some geometrical figure, some utilization of the lines of the cube, and their demonstration in a form of some kind. Intricate and uncertain in outline and crude in design are the forms of the earlier lives. Definite and clear in outline are the forms built by the average man, advanced man of this generation. But when he steps upon the path of discipleship, the purpose consists in merging all these many lines into one line, and gradually this consummation is achieved.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate that. The last sentence of this passage is especially telling, isn't it? The purpose consists in merging all these many lines into one line. To better understand this, let's take a closer look at the nature of the line, which is mathematically defined as a continuous extent of length without breadth made up of an infinite series of points. We know that because it represents a pair of opposites, it is the fundamental symbol of duality. Really, symbols like other symbols that represent duality, like the yin-yang symbol, really take their emphasis from the line. A line's inherent polarity allows it to carry the impact of its originating point to its receptive endpoint, as in, let light stream forth into the minds of men, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. And finally, we have that line that is as yet to be directly established, and is thus expressed as, let purpose guide the little wills of men. The difference between guidance and streaming forth is significant. Humanity is not yet ready for the streaming forth of the will of God, though we're told the direct link between Shambhala and humanity is being forged. Armed with the understanding that the line represents transmission and relationships, what do you think is the meaning of DK's statement? The purpose consists in merging all these many lines into one line. Any thoughts on this? Anybody have any ideas about why it would be desirable to merge all the many lines of the cube into one line? BL? Any hands raised?
I don't see any hands yet. Yes, I do. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, the word that comes to mind is discipleship. Any point on the line fulfills what we might call living discipleship, or the becoming a living link between that which is above and that which is below. And every segment, red to blue, red to blue, red to blue, is a different place in the chain of living discipleship.
Gosh, that was very well said. Thank you. Yes, I think the key point there being the idea of link. And if we understand the line as the most direct form of transmitting the intent to the receiver of that intent, the point to the end point, then you can see that the line, intricacy diffuses the transmission, right, and impression from higher sources, whereas a single line is naturally strengthens that connection. So we have the point representing a unified source and the line representing duality, and thus a means for the energy of that source to reach its objective. Now, what about the surface, the third element in all 3D figures? Well, what does the surface do? How does it affect the points and lines that define it? Any thoughts on this? BL, anyone have any ideas about how the surface affects the points and lines that define it?
Not yet.
It's not that complicated. You might be thinking that I'm looking for a very esoteric answer, but actually it's not that difficult.
Okay, I've got Iris, hold on just 1 second. Surface resolves planes of gradation is what Yogi has said. Iris, go ahead.
It unites them.
That's it. Yes. It combines them into a new unity. You know, the Greeks described the threeness represented by the surface as the first to make actual the potentialities of the monad, right? Oddness, perfection, proportionality, but for our purposes here, unification and limit. So it's limited in a way that the point is not. And yet it is the first to express the intent of the point. Thank you for that.
And we have another comment from Constance. It says, the service contains the content.
The service contains the content.
I'm sorry, surface.
Surface, oh yeah. Well, I was really stretching there, but yeah, the surface contains the content. Another way of saying that is appearance. We could say that what a surface expresses is defined by the intent of the points and the quality of the lines that form it. So we have points related to the first aspect of divinity, called in arrays and initiations, the mystery of fire itself, expressing intent and purpose. Lines related to the second aspect of divinity, called the mystery of polarity, expressing quality, and surfaces related to the third aspect of divinity called the mystery of electricity and expressing appearance. But we're not quite finished, are we? What unifies the surfaces of an object? Anybody have any ideas of what form or what idea would unify the surfaces of an object? Biel, anybody?
Yes.
Any thoughts?
Yes. Go ahead, Scott.
Great.
Tetrahedron, making it three-dimensional.
Yes. Well, that's a little more specific than what I had in mind, but it is the first, and therefore, you could call it the archetype of all forms. But it is volume, right, or space within a figure, right? That whatever figure that where you have points, lines, and surfaces, when they're combined in such a way that they enclose a space, the space unifies the combined expression of the other three. Do you see how that works? So philosophically, we could say that the space within a given 3D figure is conditioned by the appearances of the surface, which are conditioned by the quality of the lines, which are in turn conditioned by the intent of the points. So we see that all 3D figures are made up of four elements: points, lines, surfaces, and space or volume, which progressively define the intent, quality, appearance, and unified embodiment of any given figure. I have it, as Scott pointed out, the first of these is a tetrahedron, and so I have that depicted here. This determines the path, these four determine the path into the world of form, and is essential in understanding the link between fourness and manifestation. Where there is space, there is fourness. As we have seen, DK extols simplicity because it enables a more direct connection with the higher planes. The example of the line shows this, right? Thus, we can surmise that the tetrahedron, the simplest and most synthetic, that is, the one that demonstrates synthesis, of the simplest of all the forms, is the most fundamental expression of these four elements in combination: point, line, surface, and space. Indeed, we could view it as the perfected archetype for all forms, including all units of sentient life, which DK calls in stanza 6 of the stanzas of Zan, the fourfold ones. Some of you might have had time to catch the splash screen and at the beginning of the webinar that gave stanza 6, which is the progression of the evolution of the fourfold one. And that's us, guys. Okay. During the fifth webinar in this series, we applied the Vesicapithes, a two-dimensional figure, to the great invocation. Now that we've moved into three dimensions, and since the tetrahedron is capable of noumenal expression or primary expression, let's see how it would work to use this figure as a vehicle for the great invocation. Now, you know, in giving you these examples, keep in mind that I am never saying this is the way it is. What I'm really trying to do is portray how various geometrical figures can be used for specific purposes. So the idea is to get you to start thinking in that way yourselves. That's when you start really entering this realm of sacred geometry, when you can start utilizing these concepts and forms in your own awareness. So if we assign the three points of an equilateral triangle to represent the sources of will, love, and light, a unified surface is formed representing the threefold Godhead. Many paintings and icons in the Christian tradition depict God with a triangular halo. Here are some more esoteric versions of the same idea. The image in the upper right allows us to easily trace the fourfold progression into the world of form. Do you see the connection between the column on the left and this illustration on the right? Though at first the four elements on the left seem quite different than the figure on the right, they're essentially depicting the same thing. Though duality is represented by the line on the left and by the vesica pisces on the right, and form, or the many, is represented by the volume of the tetrahedron on the left and by a solar radiance on the right. The main real difference here is that the figure on the right gives us a unified expression of the four in one, and therefore also shows us the path back towards unification. This Masonic symbol shows the same progression, doesn't it? I'm sure that given what you just saw, that that all of you could pick out the elements that represent all four of these ideas. The hands clasped in brotherhood depict duality leading to unity, and the square, excuse me, and leaves symbolizing the natural world. Let me get a glass of water here. Let's see. Okay. But let's get back to the Great Invocation. This is, by the way, a three-dimensional view of a tetrahedron with the flat surface seen at an angle on the top, right? It's not what you call an orthogonic view, but is a perspective view of the tetrahedron. If we choose to have the lines that stream forth represent a means of transmitting the quality of those three points to the fourth point, which we'll assign to the center, which is called the race of men, three additional surfaces are generated, right? You move from a triangle, which I showed you before, right? Oh, it's way back here. Yes. And then the dropped point, which we're assigning to the center, which is called the race of men, gives us, that's what actually draws this two-dimensional figure into three dimensions, right? The resulting surface delineates a tetrahedron conditioned by the three aspects of divinity. So you see, each of the sides of the tetrahedron, if, and this is essential, you assign light, love, and will to the initiating points, each of the sides then become conditioned by those, by two of the three of those elements, right? The resulting space, vibrating in accord with the source of will, love, and light, can thus be seen as the ultimate temple. You're in the very highest expression of the realm of form. All the sides enclosing, all the enclosing sides are triangular, and therefore the space is most directly consecrated by the qualities of light, love, and will. By the way, the lines emanating from the three divine points are pretty clearly related to the three aspects of three rays of aspect, right? The receptive fourth point, which changes the triangle into a tetrahedron, is related to the fourth ray, the ray that governs humanity. In fact, the tetrahedron as a whole could be seen as an expression of the fourth ray. It's interesting in this regard to note how some of the names of the fourth-rate Lord relate to the tetrahedron. Among that great being's many names are the dweller in the holy place, which corroborates our idea that the tetrahedron is a natural temple. Another is the mountain whereon form dies. As a tetrahedron is the archetype for all form, the highest manifestation of form, climbing the mountain can be seen as moving one beyond the realm of form. Very Capricornian. And third, we have the seed that is the flower. This is another name of this fourth-ray Lord, the seed that is the flower. The apex of the tetrahedron carries within it the potential or seed of that which manifests, which is represented by the triangular base. And finally, among these names, there are many more than I'm describing here, we have the trumpet of the Lord. Note that it is the trumpet, not the trumpeter of the Lord. Kudos to Gabrielle Herbertson for intuiting this connection. She wrote me an email saying that tetrahedron seemed to her like a trumpet. And you can immediately see that, like the seed, the fourth point of the tetrahedron represents potential sound in the form of the mouthpiece of the trumpet, which when blown gives us the threefold word, the AUM, represented by the triangular base. Revelations tells us, the seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven which said, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord. Esoterically, this linking of the kingdom of God with the world is the ultimate purpose of the triple sound and of the fourth ray, which is to transform conflict or disharmony into harmony. So we find this bridging quality in two additional names associated with the fourth ray Lord, the divine intermediary and the link between the three and the three. That gives us 3-4-3, which is 7 times 7 times 7. 777 is the number of Sanat Kumara, the planetary logos. So you can see the importance of this linking process. Okay, let's move on. We've come to know Fornus both as the lower quaternary and as the midway point, which is actually the highest aspect of the lower quaternary. The tetrahedron seems best suited to represent the midway point, whereas the cube, the platonic solid most often associated with the number 4, seems best suited to represent the lower quaternary. But before I present my own analysis, let's once again apply DK's threefold method, this time to the cube. So could I get a reader for this?
Not yet.
Volunteers?
Volunteers, raise
please.
Your hand.
If you have a headset, please raise your hand.
Here we go. Oops. I'm sorry. Take yourself off self-mute, please, Walter. Thanks.
Exoterically, this involves study of its form as a whole, of its lines, and therefore of its numerical significance, and also study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements.
Thank you, Walter. So what can we say about the lines, the numerical significance, and the arrangement of the forms that make up the cube? At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for a tabulation of this figure's physical attributes. We'll be making a mental list, since I won't be making a physical list, and we'd love to have you participate in this. Raise your hand if you have any thoughts about some quality, no, some physical attribute that would describe the cube.
Go ahead.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me say one thing before you do, Walter. Since comparison and contrast often help us to better understand a subject, feel free to also note the physical similarities and differences between the cube and the tetrahedron. Your observation may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. Any observation that that helps us physically define the cube is useful. So I've started the list with two ideas. The cube contains six squares that together enclose a space. The cube contains eight vertices, which are the points, six faces, and 12 edges. Okay, Walter, what's your idea?
Yeah, the lines of a cube are all at right angles to each other.
Yes, indeed they are, and it's the only Platonic solid in which that is the case. Other ideas? Physical attributes of the cube. Anything at all?
If you divide it to nine.
Vera?
I wanted to say symmetry, but I think it's not the only form which is symmetrical.
It doesn't matter if it's the only form. It's perfectly fine to state a physical characteristic that, you know, it shares with other forms. But yes, it's very symmetrical, isn't it? It tends to really scream symmetry, doesn't it? Other thoughts? Other observations?
Go ahead, Luca.
Yes, it is a building block. This is the only solid that you can combine with others of its kind and fill up space completely.
Thank you. Yes, it certainly is the only Platonic solid that you can do that with, and it's by far the most commonly used building block. Other physical attributes of the cube. Anything more?
Asha says, would all the outer points touch a sphere that might surround it?
It sure would, and that sphere is called the circumsphere. And I will be illustrating that in a moment. This is true of all the Platonic solids, that the outer points touches an imaginary sphere. Yes, good observation. Other ideas?
Go ahead, Vera.
Yeah, it's sort of stable in terms of like movement. It's not easy to move it. Yeah.
Off itself. Yes. Yeah, of course, it's the idea of four square, right? It's solid. Yes, indeed. It's not the most stable. The tetrahedron is actually the most stable, but nonetheless, it is in our world considered, you know, the paragon of stability, you could say. Other ideas? Anything else?
Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, there's clearly an inner sphere as well, based on the central point of each of the faces. And both the inner sphere and the circumsphere are centered in the same point.
Yes, the same central point, right.
Right.
Yeah, it's called the N sphere, and I'll also be illustrating that in a moment. That's correct. Other ideas?
I don't see any more hands or any more comments.
Okay, that's fine. Let's. I'll give you a few additionals. Of the six faces, four stand vertically, two are horizontal. I know you're all saying, I could have thought of that. But, you know, sometimes the most obvious of these observations can prove to be helpful when you're extrapolating meaning and significance from them. And as Walter Pullen pointed out, thanks, Walter, for this, last month I think you said that all platonic solids except the tetrahedron have a horizontal face on top, and the cube, which is the first to illustrate that. Okay, of the 12 edges, 4 stand vertically, 8 horizontally. And as someone pointed out, all the angles in the cube are 90 degrees. In no other Platonic solid are all the edges and faces aligned along the horizontal and vertical axes. The cube is the second of 5 Platonic solids. The cube is the only 6-faced solid, which is why it's also called the hexahedron. Unlike the tetrahedron, wherein all 4 vertices stand equidistant from one another, the vertices of a cube stand in 3 significant distances from each other. If we assign a value of 1 to the shortest distance, to one edge, the distance diagonally across each of the faces of the cube is the square root of 2, and the distance across the interior space of the cube is the square root of 3. Both of these are very significant. If you remember that the distance from the top of the mandorla, which is the inner part of the vesica piscis, the top point to the bottom point in comparison to its width is also the square root of 3. And this brings forth this relationship, is what allows all forms to be birthed through the vesica piscis. And you'll find that there's that this quality of birthing is also true of the cube and the square root of 2, but in a different way. I'll be covering that probably next time. By the way, the diagonal length of the face of a double cube is the square root of 5. So the cube holds within it, within its form, the numbers 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, and 26, all even numbers. As in all Platonic solids, a cube's vertices are equidistant to its central point. And as we discovered last month, I believe Martin just brought up this point, all Platonic solids have 3 associated spheres, the smallest of which, called the n-sphere, is tangential to the center point of each face. The second sphere is tangential to the middle point of each edge, and the largest sphere enclosing the entire figure, I think Vera brought up this, called the circumsphere, is tangential to the vertices. As the volume of a cube is the third power of its size, a times a times a, all third powers are called cubes, as in cubing a number, right? Just as the term square is used to determine all second powers. As we discovered last month, the dual of a cube is an octahedron, and the dual of an octahedron is a cube. This reciprocity is an attribute of all duals. By the way, a dual, you may remember, is the solid form by connecting the center points of a figure to one another. There are 2 orthogonal views. Orthogonal just means two-dimensional. 2 orthogonal views of a cube, which will reveal both its fourfold and sixfold nature. A cube has 11 nets. It's an astonishing number of nets that you can use to make the cube. This is a quality of even numbers. Remember I said that there's the numbers 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, and 26. Well, that quality manifests in terms of how many nets can be used to construct a cube. If you like working with your hands, I strongly recommend constructing at least one of the Platonic solids, and go ahead and construct them all if you enjoy yourselves, because you'll gain a lot of insight into the nature of these figures in a way that studying pictures of them just can't give you. Also, I find that just having these constructions around the house stimulates my contemplation of their nature. It's actually a lot of fun to build them, and it's not that hard to do. Here is one of the nets for a cube with the glue tabs, which you can easily find online. Just Google cube net or any figure and net, and you'll get an illustration that you can then print out, cut out, and glue up. Okay, the point of this physical analysis is to stimulate our imaginations so that we might discover meaning and significance in the cube's physical attributes. With that in mind, let's move to the next phase of our analysis. Could we have a reader? Someone who hasn't read, please, if you have a headphone, have a headset. Maybe only three or four of you have headsets, but that hasn't been the case in the past. So if we could get a volunteer to read this, please.
Go ahead, please, Asha.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Conceptually, this involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name, at its meaning as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire that arouses in you.
Thank you, Asha. Okay, DK ascribes meaning to the concrete mind and significance to the emotional realm. So, considering our list of physical attributes, what meaning or significance can we ascribe to the cube? Here's a couple of examples, just to get you some idea of what we're looking for here. The use of the square and the cube to represent the manifested realms is found in many spiritual disciplines and philosophies. The name, cube, also defines the path into form. Remember DK telling us the underlying idea may be expressed in the name itself? Well, the act of cubing a number takes us from the first through the second and into the third dimension, or power of that number. The two can be seen as equated. This idea of moving from one dimension to the next might also be applied to moving from one plane to the next. So, I've seeded the pot. Now I'm ready for a cornucopia of ideas come pouring out. Any further ideas about the meaning and significance of the cube? As you're thinking about this, keep in mind our list of physical attributes. So, BL, do you have any takers?
Yes.
Great.
Please go ahead, Scott.
Well, there's solidity, there's stability, there's reliability, there's earthiness. Mm-hmm. These are all emotional to me. They're qualities of this plane.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Before sighted, anyway.
Yes, and the last that you mentioned, earthiness, is, I think the cube is actually the sort of, in the same way that the tetrahedron represents fire, doesn't the cube represent earth?
Yes, it does.
I thought so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's true, yeah. Those ideas are all begin to fill out the sense of what the cube is about for us, right? Other ideas. What is the significance and meaning of the cube? If you're having trouble with this, grab some physical attribute and then extend it into the world of meaning and significance. Anyone?
Can you
hear
me?
Thoughts on this?
You have a question here from Asha. Do you have any Yes. comments or info about the black cube of Mecca?
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I do have a thought, but let me get back to you on that before. Let's allow people to contribute first.
Okay, then Martin, please go ahead.
I'm drawn either emotionally or mentally or triadally to the sphere and the idea of sphere within sphere and the fourness of the ether. In other words, if we're talking about appearance, each of the surfaces could be looked at as a face. And I think that's a very, very important phrase to meditate upon about the face. There's horizontal faces and vertical. We face upwards and we face downwards and therefore become the living link. We face outwards, etc. That needs to be reflected upon. And also the idea of the physical ether being contained, one sphere being contained within the what we might call the triadal sphere, the higher ether, the cosmic ether, is all implied here. And that has to do with this achieving of synthesis along the same lines as everything reducing to one vertical line. When you reach the point of the right relationship of all the angles, all the faces, all the vertices, you basically reach that point of synthesis, which changes from a geometric cube into this series of spheres, and one implies the other. So, I mean, I could go on.
No, that's it. You do go on if you have more to say.
No, that's not.
Okay. Fascinating observations. Yes, the sphere that is, in a sense, circumscribed by the cube could be seen. Remember, none of these things are absolute truths. They're understandings that we gain through contemplation of the object, right? So the sphere that's circumscribed by the cube could be seen as the sphere of the personality, since the cube is so often related to the lower kingdoms and to the lesser self. We could see that the being circumscribed completely by the cube, and that would be the end sphere, could be seen as the sphere of our functionality, of our thought within the realm of the cube, whereas the circumsphere, which lies completely outside, the surface lies completely outside the sphere except for the 8 points, or the 8 vertices which touch it, which suggests the connection with the personality more than being conditioned by the personality, could represent a realm of consciousness that infuses the cube or the personality, but stands outside it in terms of its influence. These are just ideas. And then the midway point, the sphere that touches each of the center points of the lines, could be seen as a kind of a midway point, very much like the fourth subplane, you know, where you're ruled both by personality and by soul infusion. These are just ideas, you understand, and that's the whole point. Remember, the forms themselves, the sacred geometry, always stands in a causal position to anything that we can say about it. So therefore, you're not going to have any absolute truth about a form, because the form stands beyond any words that we could say. Okay, has this sparked any other thoughts?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Good, good, good.
Okay. Walter, go ahead, but you have to take yourself off. Yeah, there you go.
Yes. Another quality or subjective attribute of the cube, I would say, to me, is initiality or simplicity. In other words, for me, at least in my life, the cube was the first figure I learned about or knew how to, say, draw or compute the volume of, while many of the other Platonic solids are much more complicated or came much later.
Yes. And that also suggests that it very much belongs to this realm of comprehension, which is called the lower mind, doesn't it? You know, when we're given an irrational number, we're pitched, in a sense, beyond beyond the realm of the lower mind. But when all you have to do to get the volume is multiply the side times the side times the side, you're definitely in this realm. So yes, thank you. Other thoughts?
Let's see. Victor, please go ahead.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Victor.
When I see a solid or one of these platonic shapes, you don't see it in nature. So immediately, to me, it brings to mind humanity or intelligence, you know. Mm-hmm. If you were to travel to a distant planet, let's say, you would look for, if you saw these kind of shapes, to me, it would automatically say, hey, there's intelligent life here.
Mm, that's very interesting. Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're a product of our thinking, aren't they? And yet, we're told that they also stand on the highest planes in a noumenal or causal relationship to physical plane reality. But the apprehension of those causal forms occurs through the mind. So thank you for that. Yes, indeed. It's like you say, you can walk forever in the natural world and not find these forms. Any other thoughts?
Go ahead, please, Vera.
Yeah, again, that stability, which is based on that 90 degrees angle, which is like two faces squaring each other, that's the most difficult point to get them move into some other sort of shape, form or direction, so that the stability comes from the direct opposition. Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting, yes. You know, it brings me to this thought that you can't actually get further from coincidence or coinciding. I'm not making sense. One face cannot get farther from the other than a perpendicular, because when you move beyond, say, to 100 degrees instead of 90, you're actually moving back towards that original face. So it represents that which is in most complete opposition possible. Yes. Okay, other ideas?
Yes, we have a couple of more hands, but also some comments. So let me get to the comments. Constance, my understanding in the work of triangles is that we are in the process of transforming the etheric body of Earth from square to triangle and eventually into a sphere. And when it becomes spherical, the Earth will be a sacred planet.
Yes, actually, Dwell Cool directly, there's a direct quote, and I think I gave it out in a previous webinar that says as much as what you just said, which is that at this point, the etheric web of this planet is a series of squares, and that the energy is impeded. Which was that Vera that just spoke before?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Vera pointed out, you know, that it's difficult to move. It's in a sense the most difficult relationship between two planes. So that we're in the process of moving this square-based etheric web into a triangular one, and that at that point the energy will be able to move much more freely, which basically means the life force through prana, which is how the life force responds to and infuses the etheric bodies, will have a much freer reign and be able to more deeply affect all the forms of the planet. And we are part of that etheric web, of course. There is, you know, when you have etheric vision, you see no separation between the etheric web of the planet and the etheric webs of each of us, right? So that means, by extension, that our own etheric webs will also be transformed from squares to triangles. In terms of the sacred, I think that actually, when we move to the triangular form of web, that's when we become sacred. The circular form is at this point the only body in this solar system that has circles of etheric web is the solar logos itself. The sacred planets have triangular forms, but that's just another level of sacredness that will be achieved. So yes, thanks for that observation. It definitely gives us some idea of the form nature, which is tends to act, tends to resist the spirit nature represented by the triangle. Okay, other ideas?
Yes, we still have a couple of hands and another comment, but let's go to Scott, who's patiently had his hand up for a really long time. Go ahead.
Okay. The rectilinear quality of the cube speaks of, well, you see it in masonry in the three working tools, the primary working tools of a mason, which are the plumb, the level, and the square. Mm-hmm. And they speak to qualities of morality and uprightness, mm-hmm. Which you see in the cube and just in the square as well. And also thinking in terms of the cube of, in terms of directions, you have four directions in this plane, and you have one above and below that takes you into other planes.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, and they define, if you were to move to the center point of the cube and attach that center point to the midpoint of each face, you have what Scott's describing. Go ahead, Scott.
And we'll go finish that.
No, that's my point, that you would have what you were just describing, the cube, in a sense, through its faces, the center point of its faces, describes the six directions that you're describing. Yeah.
Well, we think we speak in terms of moving in directions, and then we are and honoring the four directions, but more recently we connected with a more ancient idea of six directions here, mm-hmm. and that there's a verticality here as well as just a horizontal movement. And it's the vertical that is the sacred, and it's the horizontal that is communal and links us in a mm-hmm. circle. And the vertical takes the circle and makes it spherical.
Mm-hmm. Yes, otherwise we have a flat plane. Thank you. Other ideas?
Okay, comment from Gabriel. The lines generated by connecting the center points of each face form several crosses, as if it were the implicit cross of form that hints at the inherent purpose of the form, the form world for the disciple.
Very good, yes. In fact, if you connect the vertices of any of the face, you have the mutable cross, because it's the mutable cross looks like an X, as you'll see a little later if we get to it. So you have every face representing the mutable cross, but then you also have, when you incorporate the center point, which is what Scott was just describing, you have a different kind of cross, the upright cross. So you're seeing two potentials. Very much like A times A times A, you're seeing the cube is a form of transport. It can move you from one potential to the next, and the type of cross is an example of that. Very good. Anyone else?
Yes. Another comment, this from Helen. Containment of potential opposing faces creating tension and crisis. Mm-hmm.
Yes. We, even though this is a completely different subject, which I'll touch on in the next webinar. As we know, the squares in astrology provide a more challenging relationship between those that lie in a relationship with the square, right? So yes, indeed.
And one more hand. Go ahead, please, Martin.
Yes, I just have a question for Francis regarding the rhomboid and the diamond and putting the cube on, not on the flat surface, but on one of its angles so that the other angle is above it. And basically, that creates a whole different dynamic instead of the stability. Instead of the stability of a flat surface and the vertical and the higher and the lower, then your higher and lower are at the two vertices, the one that's on a balance point and the one that's above it. And it implies, with extension, a rhomboid and then a diamond and also the vesic epiphysis, doesn't it?
Yeah. BL, can you turn my
image back on?
Talking head back on?
Okay.
Can you do that very easily? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I have a cube here, so I can just show what you're talking about.
No, it's not letting me.
Oh, maybe. Oh, well. Okay. You have this cube illustrated on the slide here, so you imagine it up on point. And first of all, you've defied gravity, which means by doing that, you're looking at it, in a sense, out of the realm of the finite world, which is, in other words, its natural position is sitting on one of its faces, but that's not its only potential. And yes, indeed, it becomes an entirely different figure when put end to end, because then what you're doing is you're conforming to an axis, not from the middle point of the face to the middle point of the face, but from the diagonal that represents the square root of 3, which is across the core of the cube to its any opposing point, right? And that, when you set that up as a vertical, then of course that becomes the dominant energetic, doesn't it? Rather than when you have it sitting on its face, the dominant energetic is the axis that runs from the top face to the bottom face, which is mirrored by, you know, all four vertical axes, which is just, it's the most finite aspect of the cube, the one, you could say, the, you know, the defining quantity of the cube. But when you move it on point, you're looking at the square root of 3, which is key to the equality of the golden mean and the and relationship of one to the other within the form. It basically introduces the concept of the other, or the higher self, right? So yes, that's a very important quality. Does anybody else have any thoughts about this? If you set it up on point, what do you have? All of the faces become diamonds, in a sense, rather, even though they're squared, they have more of the quality of diamonds rather than of square faces. Martin, since you brought up the idea, do you have any other thoughts about that?
No, I was just asking what you knew.
Well, that's what I. That's what.
Well, I agree. If we think about the diamond soul, I think that gives a clue, and I think this gives us a clue on how to transform the network of squares or cubes into a network of triangles or diamonds, and it has to do with recognizing the verticality of all relationships and reducing all of the many lines into the central line, which becomes the halving of the sphere. So I think basically if we're thinking too much in terms of form and geometry and the various Platonic solids and not realizing this, the shifting to the vertical, the only stability that comes once you create this rhomboid diamond balanced on a point is the spinning of the object, creating a dynamic sphere of energy radiating from the center outward. Well, like that sun you previously had in a previous image, were in one enclosed in the enclosing the various forms was a sphere, and that sphere was radiatory. So I think we as disciples become disciples when we recognize our place in the verticality of things. Mm. We recognize that our balance point becomes, you know, then when we achieve that level, that centering and that verticality and our recognition of being a living link in a dynamic chain, then we take on a radiatory quality and the various forms become alive and radiatory and magnetic. So there's a whole implicate order of, like you say, a relationship to the other, and the other, and it also then leads to the relationship to the true self. So, I mean, there's an awful yes. lot contained in it.
Yes, there is. And it's interesting. I'm holding this cube as I'm doing this and looking. And you have basically two positions, which is in one position you have a square facing upwards and two facing downwards. And then when you turn it 45 degrees, you have two squares facing upwards and one square downwards. So there's an alternating quality as you rotate it of 2-1, 2-1, 2-1, 2-1, 2-1. And if you were to spin it at a very rapid rate, it would actually look like a six-pointed figure because the 2-1 would blend to form a side on each one. But I'm stepping too far out with that. Let's pull it back in a little bit.
I have just one thing to say. I won't say more than this, but basically this is the difference between a universe, a paradigm of the universe based on gravity and a paradigm of the universe based on electricity. But we won't go into that. That's way beyond the scope of this. But that's implied.
Not so far beyond the scope of, when we get into talking about color,
yeah,
we'll talk about electricity because color is the fourth iteration of electricity. So it's relevant. But yeah, hold that thought.
I will. Thank you, Francis.
Yeah. Okay, so you can see there's a lot more than meets the eye in looking at a cube. And, you know, if you do, even just, you know, grab any container or something around the house if you don't have a cube handy, and put it on one end, and you'll see that the quality of the thing changes radically. All right. More thoughts before we move on.
Yes, we have a comment from Orest, but before I unmute him, we also have a comment from Claire typed. Let me see. We see in the cube the vital energies of stasis and motion, the contained and the container, each face and dynamic suggesting individuality and relationship, independence and interface. Each of these being essential qualities of unification and forthright relationships.
Wow, that's terrific. Yes, the contained and the container, indeed. Yeah. Thank you for that, Claire. Claire comes to us from New Zealand. Any final comments before we move on?
Orest, please go ahead.
My most exciting experience with the cube was with the Steiner course. They gave us a lump of clay, and we first made a sphere and then a cube. And then once we had the cube, we had to depress the corners or the nodes. And by doing that, we gradually made progressively each of the platonic solids. So this was a dynamic three-dimensional way of actually shaping all of the platonic solids, starting with a lump of clay, forming the cube, and then depressing the corners. Very exciting.
Yeah, I bet it was. Yeah, well, right away, if you push in on the corners of a cube, you're moving it towards its dual, right? If you flatten the corner all the way until it actually reaches the other corner, you have its dual, which in this case is an octahedron. So yes, you can transform one solid into the next in this way. Thank you for that. A comment on Claire's idea of contained and container. Again, you can look at the spheres that surround the cube to represent this quality of the contained and the container. The container would be more relevant to the end sphere, which the cube entirely contains, and then the exosphere, which is called the circumsphere, represents, in a sense, that which contains the cube, which is the soul, right? So, okay, any other comments before we move on?
That's all I see. You got all the hands and all the comments.
Outstanding. So. Okay, just great contributions. Thanks very much. Okay. Here are some additional ones. Some of these you will have contributed to, but I have illustrations. So, whereas the tetrahedron is fourness, conditioned by the triangle, the cube is sixness, conditioned by the square. Now, whereas three stands for spirit, six, as is shown in the six-pointed star, represents spirit fixed in matter. And you can see that around that six-pointed star is the shape of the cube, one of the orthogonic views of the cubes. So the sixness, here's the orthogonic view on the right. If you use your imagination, you can actually see, look at that one on the right three-dimensionally, and you see that you've lined up the points in the middle that represent, when moving from one to the other, the square root of three. Okay. Six is also the number of manifested subplanes in each plane. The seventh subplane, called the Udi plane, is always formless, noumenal, hidden, and yet carries within it the potential of the six manifested planes. This is one reason why seven is associated with the Virgin Mother. But it is the fourness of the square with its pairs of opposites that give the cube its particular quality. In fact, because of its strict adherence to the vertical and horizontal axes, no other geometric form is as strongly conditioned by duality. Every face has an opposing face. Every line has an opposing line. Every pair of lines, an opposing pair. Whereas the tetrahedron can be seen as a triple radiation of four points, in the cube, the focus shifts from the point to the line, as is indicated in this quote from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. DK says, the lines become allied and cubes are formed, shielding the inner fire, suggesting that it's somehow in the aligning, allied and alignment being, from the same root, that this aligning of the lines as opposed to the points, which is more tetrahedral, this has the quality of shielding the inner fire. DK also tells us, and this is pretty unequivocal, four lunar lords constitute what the ageless wisdom teaching calls the four sides of the square. They are the lower quaternary, the imprisoning cubes, or the cross upon which the inner spiritual man is to be crucified. This suggests that the cube and the cross are closely related, and we can see this connection when we unfold the cube. Also, when connected to the other vertices, one of you brought this up, I can't remember which, the central point of the cube and each of the cube's faces creates a cross, and you can see the difference in the nature of the crosses here. You have the the mutable cross represented by the green lines on each of the faces, and more of the along the lines of the fixed cross, actually two fixed crosses in the center. The act of unfolding and of finding the central point can be seen as a metaphor for becoming self-aware, first through personality integration, then through progressive aspiration, discipleship, and initiation. Thus, it's no surprise that the cube, as well as the line and the cross, which are elements of the cube, constitute three of the nine symbols that D.K. tells us every disciple must master before becoming an initiate. He says in Initiation Human and Solar concerning these nine symbols, can we get a reader for this? It's short, but if somebody else could read this, please.
Volunteers, hands, please. Oops. Go ahead, Walter.
Yes. All these symbols, allied, interwoven, or taken in part, are combined to express one or other of the seven secrets of initiation. The initiate has to recognize them by sight as well as to hear them, and by an effort of the will to imprint them irrevocably upon his memory.
Thanks, Walter. If you needed a further motivation for studying sacred geometry and symbols, here it is. It's a necessary part of the study for preparation of becoming an initiate. So, what do you think it's like to hear a cube? Maybe there's a hint in the idea of cubing a number, root, third, fifth. It's interesting to note that hearing on the Buddhic plane is called comprehension. Since D.K. has made such definitive statements about the cube, we can hypothesize that all its attributes, like, for instance, its 90-degree angles, contribute to the cube's character or quality. So when we see 90-degree angle elsewhere, we have, by association, some understanding of its nature. In this case, that it has to do with the form world, right? And as Scott pointed out, how to act in an upright manner in the realm of form. This is corroborated by the fact that the 9 in 90 degrees is connected with the idea of fullness of manifestation and with completion. Okay. Do we have any additional observations about the subjective nature of the cube before we move on? Oh, by the way, I wanted to answer, I'm not sure who had the question about the Kaaba, which I think it's called, Q-A-A-B-A, I think. Anyway, it's the central form in Mecca. The only idea that comes to mind is that the cube represents a kind of archetypal form, and the fact that it's black suggests the hidden or that which is beyond knowing, the unknowable. So it could be seen as an abstraction for God or for the realm of godliness. But those are just my ideas. I've never read any interpretations on this. Okay. So any last bright ideas before we move on? Okay. Let's go back here. Let's move into the third phase of DK's analysis. I'm going to start calling on you guys, the ones that I know have headsets. Arrest, would you be so kind as to read this third part of the analysis?
esoterically, this would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind. Dilemma, a world problem.
Thank you. So, having familiarized ourselves with the cube, at least to some extent, let's seize the moment and reflect on where in ourselves it affects us, how it affects us. A benefit of working with three-dimensional figures is that we can visualize ourselves inside them. But if you prefer, you can picture the cube before you, on end or otherwise. Keep in mind as you visualize that symbols and geometric figures, rather than being descriptions of potencies, are inherently potent. Thus, they have the potential to penetrate and reveal. We'll take exactly 1 minute for this meditation, starting now. Okay. Actually, during that meditation, it occurred to me that the root chakra has four petals, which is very strongly related to what we're discussing. A couple of webinars back, we emphasized the particular importance of the number four at this time in our planet's history, specifically that the fourth subplane is the plane of release, and that at least in part, this is true because we're in the fourth globe of the fourth round of the fourth chain, which has as its goal the dominance of the fourth physical ether. DK tells us that dominating the fourth ether of the physical subplane is the work of all who would aspire to be white magicians. But what does this mean? Why specifically the fourth ether? Why is the fourth subplane even relevant to the path of discipleship? The answer seems to lie in the fact that the fourth subplane of the physical, astral, and mental planes are all interconnected, and that as a result of establishing even the faintest connection to the Buddhic plane, awareness on the fourth subplane of the physical opens the way to awareness on the fourth subplane of the astral, and then to awareness on the fourth subplane of the mental. Can you see how the connection between the four subplanes might demonstrate through the cubing of a number? Involutionally, beginning on the mental plane, the line is squared, thus becoming a surface or an appearance on the astral plane. When the line is cubed, it enters the realm of volume on the fourth ether of the physical. Evolutionally, the process is reversed. Remember DK's quote, the purpose consists in merging all these many lines into one line, and gradually this consummation is achieved. Well, if this is actually correct, the line on the right would be a vertical line, because it then allows one to move from the lower to the higher mental and to soul fusion. Associating the cube with this process is just a conjecture, but interesting in light of the fact that DK describes a human being in the three worlds as man the cube. At any rate, we know that the return journey is possible through sequential mastering of the fourth subplanes, with each of these gains in awareness, connection with the Buddhic plane, the uber fourth subplane, becomes stronger. The Buddhic plane, you may remember, is the greater circle which marks the goal for man. That's from one of the stanzas. It helps me to think of these three fourth subplanes in terms of musical intervals, which naturally share a common resonance, intervals that become a fully realized chord when Buddhic plane consciousness is achieved. So, you know, if you're singing the or intoning the root note, you tend to naturally perceive the third and the fifth and the octave of that. And I'm suggesting that if you are choosing the right note, that you in fact are aligning these fourth subplanes. DK tells us, and let's get a reader for this. Would somebody like to volunteer?
Don't all raise your hands at once. There we go. Oops. Go ahead, please, Terry.
Oh, sorry. I didn't talk to somebody else.
No, when Terry, man, please.
When man begins in a small sense to coordinate the Buddhic vehicle, or to express it otherwise, when he has developed the power to contact even so slightly the Buddhic plane, then he begins simultaneously and consciously to achieve the ability to escape from the etheric web on the physical plane. Later he escapes from its correspondence on the astral plane, and finally from the correspondence on the fourth subplane of the mental plane, this time via the mental unit. This leads eventually to causal functioning, or to the ability to dwell and to be active in the vehicle of the ego. This is the embodiment of the love and wisdom aspect of the monad.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to have you with us today. So, one way to get some sense of the nature of the levels of consciousness associated with these fourth subplanes is to look at their corresponding senses. The fourth subplane of the physical plane, on which we're told all white magicians must become aware, is associated with the sense of taste. On the fourth subplane of the astral plane, taste becomes imagination. On the fourth subplane of the mental plane, taste expresses itself as discrimination. And you try to forge these connections between these as I'm reading them. Finally, on the fourth subplane of the Buddha plane, taste becomes intuition. So it's a fundamentally important sense because the source for these is, from a causal point of view, is the intuition. And really, we need to look at these in reverse order if we want to understand their cause. Taste is certainly not the cause. It's just that which we can most readily understand, that and imagination and discrimination. So intuition then becomes the source of this line of senses, which demonstrates as discrimination on the mental, imagination on the astral, and the sense of taste on the physical plane. It could be useful to meditate, or more correctly stated, to concentrate on how these four fourth plane senses are related to each other, as well as how they're related to the elements of the cube. Actually, there's even a higher sense on this line. On the fourth subplane of the Atmic plane, we have what DK calls perfection. He sums up the journey from taste to perfection as evolution completed through the utilization of the not-self and its realized adequacy. He has such a gift for understating. You know, if you actually make it to the atmic plane, you have realized the adequacy of the not-self. Of course, the not-self refers to the personality, to man, the cube. And its realized adequacy refers to the process of making that fourfold one a fit vehicle for first the soul and eventually the monad. Okay, gosh, I'm not going to have time to get into the directions this time. So we will move right on to the reading list. Next time is going to be the fourth session on the number four. So astonishing as that seems, we'll be lucky to finish this number even in four sessions, because I still want to look at the nature of the much closer look at the nature of the fourth ray, which we've just touched on. Take a good look at the Sephiroth called Chesed in the Tree of Life, how four manifests in temple construction and astrology and really many other topics. So who knows, sometime in the summer we might be looking at the number five, probably in June. Okay. The reading list remains the same, except for those who would like to try their hand at constructing the Platonic solids. For you, I recommend this book called Making Geometry by John Allen. It shows you how to make all types of geometric figures from heavy paper. I went through the entire book, made all of them, and really enjoyed the process. If you're only interested in making a couple or a few or even just all the Platonic solids, of which there are only five, you can just download the nets, as I mentioned before, from online. Just type in the solid you're interested in, like tetrahedron or cube, and then put net and look for the images, and you'll find all you need. Okay, for today's meditation, let's start by visualizing ourselves sitting within a tetrahedron. As we say the great invocation, imagine energy from each face of the surrounding, of the triangles that are surrounding us, sequentially inundating us with the energies of light, love, and will. As we see the verse beginning with from the center, which we call the race of men, visualize ourselves and the tetrahedron as one divine expression capable of sealing the door where evil dwells and thus restoring the plan on earth. So we'll begin with an om. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to throw a couple of bucks at the Moria Federation You can do that on moriafederation.com, which will help pay the yearly fee for this GoToMeeting account, which makes webinars like these possible. And thanks to Brett, these webinars are available on makara.us. And thank you, BL and Joe, for your unswerving assistance. Appreciate it very much. And finally, keep spreading the word about this webinar series. Thank you all for attending. Because the conference next month in Arizona, there won't be a webinar in April. So we'll be the very next webinar online will be on May 17th. However, there will be a live stream of my presentation at the conference entitled The Geometry of Group Work, A New Octave of Endeavor. So I hope you can check into that. It's the streaming of the conference is the next best thing to being there. I recommend it. Okay, well, bye for now.